The heated presidential campaigns are spilling into discussions about renewing legislation to protect women.
The fact that not one Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee supported the Violence Against Women Act, when many of them have done so in the past, sets people's political bells off.
Plus, how a blockbuster film is partnering with the UN to solve a major global challenge, and eating in a stressful world. I'm Susan Barnett, and it's coming up on 51%, The Women's Perspective. Since 1994, the Violence Against Women Act has provided funding and legislation in support of women's safety. It's been reauthorized by Congress twice since then, and it's up for reauthorization again. But this year, Lisa Lynn Jacobs of Legal Momentum says the political climate is creating hurdles.
Legal Momentum is a 42-year-old women's legal advocacy organization, the oldest one in the country, in fact.
Can you kind of walk us through the general what is going on right now?
I think the subtext of much of this is that it's an election year, and there seems to be a lot of grasping for political issues. And so issues which I think is a historical matter were not necessarily so complicated or controversial, have become that, both at the state level and at the federal level. I mean, at the state level, and I say this as a resident of the Commonwealth of Virginia, you know, you've just sort of seen an unprecedented level in terms of proposed legislation of intrusion into the realm of women's and family privacy. And at the federal level, you know, we have begun to see, or we've begun to be concerned, that there is, you know, an equal amount of politics, I guess, you know, that politics is playing out in ways that are also adverse to women's interests. One of the pieces of federal legislation, Legal Momentum, has had a historical involvement and commitment to is the Violence Against Women Act. It was due to be reauthorized last year. That it has not been reauthorized to this point is not that unusual, because a reauthorization process can normally take longer. But that this process has become so political seems a little bit worrying in this particular, as I said, political environment when we are looking at a national general election come November. And there certainly has been discussion in the last several weeks, or the suggestion in the last several weeks, that the fact that not one Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee supported the Violence Against Women Act, when many of them have done so in the past, you know, it at least sets people's political bells off whether or not that is really the basis of their concern or criticism or not.
And I think a lot of us, myself included, we sort of take things like this for granted. It seems obvious with a name like the Violence Against Women Act. Who would be against that? What are you hearing as the objections?
Well, and obviously, given the work that I do, I agree with you. I think the headline here should be that while the name is Violence Against Women, we who do this work understand, acknowledge, and respect the fact that violence, that there are male victims of violence just as there are female victims of violence, that violence happens in heterosexual relationships just as it happens in same-sex relationships. That said, what we have been hearing, I think, is it's sort of a cluster of concerns about three particular aspects of the bill, none of which are particularly, at least the groups that are being addressed by these proposals, are not newcomers to the radar screen of the Violence Against Women Act, if you will. So the concerns that we have heard raised arise with respect to services and or protections for immigrant victims of violence, for Native women who are victims of violence, and to address concerns regarding violence in the LGBT communities.
I'm going to have to ask you to educate us a little bit then. The immigrant population, I can definitely see where there would be a Republican concern. That's a hot button issue. And there's always the question of, you know, how many rights do we give to illegal immigrants? And I'm assuming that's kind of part of the sticking point.
Because there is a larger, yet to be addressed issue with regard to the reform of immigration, that somehow this subset of issues has been drawn into the fray. Because as I said, immigrant issues are not new to the Violence Against Women Act. We are, in fact, in the midst of reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act for the third time. What I should say first about the immigration provisions in this particular bill is that the vast majority of those provisions are there because the Department of Homeland Security either requested them or supported them. And what we do every time we reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act is to look at what has happened since the previous reauthorization. We consult with experts in the field to ask them what the needs are. And the bill that goes forward is a consensus product driven by our understanding of what the needs in the field are. And what gets folded into that are the interests and priorities and concerns of the executive branch, which is why, again, we are dealing with a bill that is, in essence, it's a consensus product, both of people who advocate against domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, dating violence, as well as law enforcement officials, representatives of the Department of Justice, who have been passionately involved in drafting and advocating around the provisions to protect or to enhance protections for Native women who are survivors of violence, and also the Department of Health and Human Services that does a lot of funding and focusing on the reduction and prevention of violence against women as well.
Okay, and I would like to talk the Native women aspect of this. That is a population that many of us don't talk about a lot, but there is apparently a huge issue of domestic violence.
Yes. Native women are at, you know, perilously greater risk across their lifespan of being either victims of domestic violence or sexual assault at some point in their lifetime. If you are a Native woman, whether or not you live on the reservation or live in an urban setting, you have a 1 in 3 chance of being a victim of sexual assault. You have a 1 in 4 chance of being a survivor or a victim of domestic violence. You know, to say that the rates are epidemic is really to understate the case. But as it's the situation with respect to addressing the needs of that particular community stand in an identical position to what I just described to you with regard to the way that we are approaching issues around immigration. Native women were addressed. There was an initial attempt to address issues around sexual and domestic violence in Indian Country in 1994, in the first Violence Against Women Act. So what really was lacking with respect to violence against women in Indian Country that we wanted to tackle, and again, as I said, that our colleagues and, you know, our colleagues at the Justice Department wanted to address, was the fact up until this proposal was put forward, and in fact, until such time as this proposal becomes law, tribal courts were only able to hold offenders who were themselves members of tribes accountable. Non-natives who were committing domestic violence and sexual assault in Indian Country could not be prosecuted by tribal courts. Now, they can be prosecuted depending on where the reservation is, either in state court or in federal court. But if you've ever been to Indian Country, there are vast swaths of Indian Country that are incredibly remote. So that if somebody is sexually assaulted on the Pine Ridge Reservation, for instance, for federal law enforcement, for the FBI to have to come up and do an investigation, it can be a trip of several hours. At which point, when the investigator arrives, if the crime scene remains, it's been compromised, the witnesses are long gone, there are good questions at that point about whether or not a victim has been able to get the kinds of services that she needs, whether or not a rape kit has been secured, and all sorts of other related issues, such that prosecution rates of domestic violence in Indian country, both at the state and the federal level, have been abysmally low for the entirety of the time that the Violence Against Women Act has been in effect. So the Justice Department was extraordinarily concerned that they needed to do more and to provide more resources to the tribal courts, which obviously are right there, to be able to hold non-Native offenders accountable. Because to the extent, offenders tend to be recidivists. And if you as an offender find yourself in a place where you know that you are beyond the reach of law enforcement for some of the reasons that I just specified, you're basically on a playground.
Okay, and I see where the hitch could be and the reasoning for why it's needed. How does the LGBT issue come into this?
Again, the LGBT community is one that has historically been recognized by the Justice Department, by the Office on Violence Against Women, as one that's eligible for services. However, you sometimes have problems when you take something like the Violence Against Women Act, which is legislative in nature and contains, on the one hand, criminal provisions and, on the other side, grant provisions. But when you take these laws and then they have to be implemented at the state level, there sometimes is a problem with the translation. Mm-hmm. People become very literal, and to the extent that you have not said explicitly in the legislation that various populations are to be served, then sometimes there is balking about whether or not there's eligibility or not, even if there is no question in the mind of the U.S. Justice Department as the funder. I hope, certainly, that the one thing we can all rally around is the notion that there should be no victim out there who has no recourse, who has to stay in a bad city or has no avenue out. And really what our uniform, universal goal is to create a Violence Against Women Act that creates avenues for all victims, whether they're immigrants or Native victims or victims of color or LGBT victims or victims in later life or victims on college campuses. We want those services to be there. We want those avenues out to be there regardless of who that victim is.
Lisa Lynn Jacobs is Vice President for Government Relations at Legal Momentum, the Women's Legal Defense and Education Fund. Find out more at legalmomentum.org. Coming up, how the Hunger Games is helping to raise awareness of global hunger, plus natural ways to balance your body and your life. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1187. Millions of people around the world don't have enough to eat. Millions of people will see the hit movie, The Hunger Games. Set in a post-apocalyptic world, the film deals with social issues including poverty, starvation, and the effects of conflict. Hollywood is teaming up with the World Food Program, and WFP's Bettina Leuscher told UN Radio's Julie Walker why.
I think there are many fans of the books among us at the World Food Program. You know, it's this story of a young girl, a teenager, who's helping her family. It plays in this futuristic society. And what intrigued us about the film was, first of all, how many people were interested in it. I think 26 million books have been sold. People are going crazy over it on the internet. Everybody's waiting for this film to come out. And what was interesting to us was what a big role hunger played. You don't often have characters that experience hunger, that fight for survival, people who really know what it means to go hungry. And a lot of that is in those books. And we thought it would be a great partnership because it introduces young people to just to the UN and to the World Food Programme, like they've never probably have heard it before. Those people, those actors, they've done a PSA with us. We have a quiz on a website, WFP.org, Hunger Games, WFP.org, Hunger Games. And I think for us at the World Food Programme, it's important to reach out to younger people, really the next generation, and tell them that hunger is a solvable problem, and partner with people who are out there in the media who can raise awareness about this issue.
What does the partnership between the Hunger Games and WFP entail?
You know, we're working together on social media campaigns. The three main characters were gracious enough to tape a public service announcement for us. You know, we're going to do some fundraising around it too. But the real thing is to push out the message. It's primarily an awareness campaign, raising awareness that hunger is the world's biggest solvable problem and what one can do. And I think many young people will learn when they go and take that hunger quiz on the website and when they watch the PSA, they're going to start thinking about it. You know, nowadays, the younger generation is so keenly aware of social issues. They're so interested. And we want to tap into that interest.
How severe is the problem of hunger in the world?
Oh, it's the number one. It's the number one problem. It is the most basic, most fundamental issue, and at the same time, it can be solved. You know, almost one in seven people on this globe are going hungry, but at the same time, we're producing enough food. And I think nowadays we have the solutions to battle hunger. We know that it's crucially important to give good nutritious food to little children, babies in the first 1,000 days of their life, because they will never, ever catch up later on. And I think we at the World Food Programme, we've really revolutionized over the last few years in our approach. In the old days, it was just handing out food. But now we're coming up with really creative tools, very special nutritious food, you know, like peanut paste and little bags, little satchels full of micronutrients that people can simply spray over their food to make it more nutritious. We've come up with great pilot programs of where we especially try to reach women farmers, small-scale farmers, and bring them into the marketplace. And I think the biggest thing of what we've changed over the last few years is that we are buying most of our food in developing countries. So they are very, very cool ideas. And at the same time, you know, the problem is so stark. There are so many places. We're seeing it in the Sahel right now. You know, where some 8 million people might be going hungry. We're seeing it in the Horn of Africa. I was just in Somalia with the hip-hop artist 50 Cent, and we looked at our operations there and how stark and difficult it is there. But at the same time, you know, if we can reach people, if we can help them, if we can raise the funds, then we can make a difference. But it takes, you know, Hillary Clinton once said it takes a village. You know, what we're saying is it takes the whole world. You need to have private sector. You need to have citizens like you and me. You need to have the young kids who are getting involved. You need to have politicians who get involved. You know, companies that come up with new products. And then we can solve hunger.
That report comes to us courtesy UN Radio. Finally, in this week's Alive and Kicking, Dr. Sharon Ufberg talks with a nutritional therapist about taking charge of your own well-being with herbs and good nutrition, particularly in stressful times.
This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Alive and Kicking. Women around this country are seeking nutritional counseling and herbal remedies in greater and greater numbers. I have with me today China Rose Reed, a nutritional therapist and herbalist, to tell us what are some of the most common reasons someone might come in for nutritional or herbal counseling. Hello, China Rose.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here with me today. So tell me, what are the top five reasons women show up in your office and asking for herbal or natural therapy?
I'd have to say number one is fatigue, and what often goes with that. Number two is trouble sleeping, digestive discomforts, a want for either weight loss or weight maintenance support. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times symptoms with hormonal imbalance. That's very common.
Let's talk about that a minute, because I know women sometimes feel very confused about this very complex balancing of hormones. What do you see when people come into your practice?
It's really important for me to help to educate women so that they understand just logistical things in their life that they can do to support themselves. So a lot of it is education about their physiology. I like to help them understand that stress is really one of the biggest causes of hormonal imbalance. When we overmake our stress hormones, that it disrupts the way that we make our progesterone, for example, and that can bring about premenstrual symptoms like mood swings, maybe bloating, cramping, heavy bleeding.
So you're talking about if you have a lot of stress and it spikes your cortisol level?
Yeah, for example, yes.
Okay, and then you might get some adrenal fatigue, which might then change. So it's this whole neuroendocrine cascade. Yes. Without getting too overly scientific. People do understand. Everybody's on the internet. People understand that there's all their hormones are now related.
Yes.
So do you see women that are still menstruating to women that are going through menopause? What do you do for them? Give me some examples.
So I really like to use the classification of herbs called adaptogens. This is a group of medicinal herbs that help to generally support the function of all of the glands in our endocrine or hormonal system. And so there are many different herbs within this category. So I pick one that seems to suit them best.
So the glands, you mean the thyroid,
yeah, the
adrenals,
ovaries,
the ovaries.
All of those. And the glands in the brain that tell those other glands when to make hormones and how much
like
to make.
Like the pituitary.
Exactly.
Oh, I feel like this is a test. I'm passing. I'm passing this test.
So it's about herbal support, but it's also about the way that they eat. If they help to balance their blood sugar by eating more often, maybe every 3 hours, littler meals and snacks that are protein rich, lower in sugar and carbohydrates, plenty of vegetables, those things also support healthier hormone levels. Eating a lot of healthy fats. I think this is a really controversial topic still in the United States, is we're not, a low fat diet doesn't support healthy hormone production.
That's important.
Yeah, cholesterol is one of the main building blocks of our hormones. So if we reduce our cholesterol too much, say we're on medication even, and our levels get too low, that can start to affect our hormonal production. So it's
the delicate balance of the hormones.
Goodness.
I know for women, it's such a mystery still. If someone were to come into a nutritional herbalist or therapist, would you be able to read their blood work and help them? Is that something you would be able to do?
That is something that I do. I do an hour and a half initial consultation. So there's a lot that goes into that. Health history, I have them fill out a food journal. I look at blood work. We might decide to do some saliva hormone testing, which can help us get really specific and mm-hmm. focused. So I'm making recommendations anywhere from lifestyle changes to dietary support, nutritional supplements, usually whole food-based supplements, and medicinal herbs, all of which help to support the body in different ways.
And how would someone find you? You do Skype counseling and over the phone as well as in person.
I do.
I know you're out here in Northern California. ChinaRoseWellness.com. China Rose Reed, thank you so much for being with me today on Alive and Kicking. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is an integrative healthcare practitioner and health journalist who hosts a regular Alive and Kicking segment here on 51%. She's also featured on KVON, KVYN, The Vine in Napa Valley, and writes for Women's E! News. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.